This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello! Happy New Year!
Now, this is Blue Monday, isn't it?
So they say. It's one of the most miserable times of the year. Yeah. I do feel that they wheel out that story on a few different Mondays in sort of January February.
I mean, it's all right for you because you're in Mexico at the moment.
This is true. I'm not even here.
No, exactly.
I'm an illusion.
Yeah. But so you're not sort of gloomy at all.
No, you're back at work.
I'm back at work.
Do you think then we do need to be honest about the fact that we're recording this slightly in the past?
Slightly in the past.
But, you know, let's not dwell on that because people are sick of the festivities. You just want to get on with the year now. How have your New Year's resolutions been going? Are you managing to keep them up?
So far, so good.
Yeah?
I think my New Year's resolution is to see friends more.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's a lovely one.
Because it was like such an intense end to 2019 with the election and everything. Determined to kind of, you know, reconnect.
That's lovely.
With people that I've lost touch with.
That's really
including
nice.
Including you.
Yeah. I mean, we have still been doing the podcast. Yeah. But, you know. So you want to know what mine is?
Go on.
To see friends a bit less. just try and withdraw. Withdraw that's a bit more. Including you.
That's perfect symmetry.
Yeah.
I mean, presumably that sort of must be possible then, that if you're seeing friends less, there's more room for me to see friends more.
Yeah, I mean, if you wouldn't mind seeing some of my friends on my behalf, that would be great. It takes it off my plate.
You're on.
Okay.
Well, let's shake hands on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So this week's episode,
Have you not got a New Year's resolution?
Every year, I think I'm going to try and be a bit more charismatic, and then it fails.
You are charismatic.
What about?
You've got the charisma of imperfection. That's what they used to say about Bill Clinton.
My posture. I could try and improve my posture for the new year.
What about doing a park run with me?
I need to build my way up to that.
Yeah.
It's a bit much to ask of me in my current state.
It is. Your state is okay, though.
It's not. I'm on the verge of sort of wearing a smock full time. That's how bad things have got, especially with the overindulgence over Christmas.
Right.
Do you think a smock would suit me?
Well, what's a smock?
Yeah, like sort of like a big flowing robe.
Oh, I see.
Like what a cult leader might wear.
Oh, I see.
Could you not imagine me in a kaftan?
I could. That's what...
We should get matching kaftans the next time we do a live show.
Remind me of a kaftan.
Sort of like a long, flowing, sort of hippie. Think of like a hippie who's gone to live in Morocco, who's dropped out and living in Morocco.
Or sort of in Oklahoma with a guru.
Yeah, any of these things. Yeah. I take it you're not into the idea.
No offence to anyone listening in Oklahoma, I isn't.
Or listening in a kaftan.
Or, you know, God live with a guru.
It's a very comfortable garment to listen to a podcast in.
Yeah. Well, I'll take it under advice.
Okay. So what we thought we'd do with this week's episode is give you a conversation that Ed had at the back half of last year, which is going to be incredibly inspiring.
Yes.
It is probably Blue Monday. I'm never quite sure when it is, but it's probably Blue Monday, and people are feeling glum, and this will get you fired up.
And
right?
It was a conversation I did with Naomi Klein, she of No Logo, and her most recent book, On Fire. About climate change, why we need a Green New Deal. It was a conversation recorded at Imperial College in front of a live audience. And it was a great conversation. And so that's what people are going to be listening to.
Before that, let me ask you, what is your first reason to be cheerful of the year?
My reason to be cheerful is that Curb Your Enthusiasm with Larry David, as you told me, it's coming back.
I sent you
series 10.
I said in the depths of the election campaign, I sent you a little trailer video to cheer you up.
I mean, I think you could be the British Larry David, couldn't you?
I feel that way. You know, I think I am one of those people. I don't think I'm alone in this, but I think I see a lot of my interactions reflected in that show.
Yeah.
But I'm just re-watching series 9, you know, the fatwa one.
Yes.
To get myself in the mood.
Yes.
For the new series.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
My reason to be cheerful is I went to see the new Star Wars film. Now, you know, as we said before... So we are recording this before Christmas. I went to see it at midnight.
We don't keep saying that.
No, but like, otherwise it's weird because it will have been out a few weeks at this point, won't it?
Well, you might have gone to see it later on
But I'm just saying I went to see it at midnight, the night it was released, and I have never seen a cinema as full, even when I've been lucky enough to go to premieres and stuff. It was rammed at midnight. I mean, there's no...
I can't imagine anything worse. Did you not want to go to bed?
No, I wanted to see the Star Wars
film. But, I mean,
film.
It's so funny, isn't it? I mean, it's like we're just so opposite. We should have been married. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, I just cannot imagine anything more grim.
My brother came down specially.
I know, and as I said to him, he looks like your son.
he's had an easier life than I have.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah. There we go.
Yeah.
Is it good?
I really enjoyed it. I thought, you know.
And you weren't like eyelids drooping at sort of.
No, I'll tell you what. We went to one of these 4D screenings. Have you heard of them? So you wear three. The yawn suggests maybe you're not terribly interested in what a 4D screening it is.
Bad night's sleep. Yeah.
Right. I was up till four watching Star Wars. What's true. Your excuse? You wear your 3D glasses, so it's already in 3D, and then you're in a chair that moves. Ooh. And it was like, you know, when you're in an airport and you've got those massage chairs that you
I've
can
never
put
done
back.
One of those.
Not much fun. And then during the film, it felt like someone who's kicking me in the back, but it wasn't. And there were flashing lights, which kept me, I was seeing the audience members, which I didn't want to see.
No water
spraying
effect.
Jets. Well, there were. They like spraying mist on you at some stage. There's jets of cold air.
Wait, what a rigmarole.
Well, it just detracts from the film. I want to go and see it again, just in normal 2D, so that I don't have to put up with any
you
of that
choose
stuff.
To see it in 4D?
Yeah, because I thought it'd be, I didn't know what 4D was. I just thought, whatever the most luxurious experience of seeing this film is going to be, because it's going to be closure.
How long did it go on for?
The film?
Yeah.
A couple of hours. Right. It's not overly long, but I definitely enjoyed it. But don't go and see anything in 4D is my advice.
Down with 4D.
Yeah.
No, it's a new campaign.
Yeah.
Down with 4D.
Don't listen to this podcast in 4D.
What do we want?
Listen
4D,
to it in a
when
kaftan.
Do we want it? Never.
No, never.
Reasons to be Cheerful, a podcast about ideas with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello, everyone. My name's Scarlett. I'm 15 years old and a member of UKSCN, which is the UK Student Climate Network. So over the past six youth strikes, we've seen hundreds of thousands of people come out onto the streets to protest the government's lack of action on the climate crisis. By definition, politics is the process by which conflict is resolved. And this is arguably the biggest conflict, the biggest crisis we have ever faced. Yet our government is not passing the scientifically necessary legislation we need. I strike because climate change won't discriminate. We need to sustain our livelihoods, our planet, our lives. And when the effects of climate change start to affect us more noticeably than they do now, we're all going to be affected. But it's those who are less privileged who will bear the brunt of it more than others. And they will be affected by it disproportionately. Climate justice and social justice go hand in hand, which is why I'm excited about Naomi's work, particularly on the Green New Deal. At UKSCN, one of our demands is for the government to implement a Green New Deal. And so Naomi's book, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal, particularly resonates with me. I'm really excited to hear a conversation, and I'm sure we're going to get some brilliant insights on the fight for our futures. Now, it's my absolute pleasure to invite you all to give a very warm welcome to Naomi Klein and Ed Miliband and invite them to take their seats.
Thank you, everyone. I know Naomi needs no introduction, but she's an amazing campaigner, author of No Logo, The Shock Doctrine, This Changes Everything, and the book you've all got to buy, On Fire, The Burning Case for a Green New Deal. I just say to the audience, you're going to get time to ask questions of Naomi in about 20 minutes or so. So I think the idea of the Green New Deal is incredibly powerful. I just want to talk a bit about that, because you say in your book something which I think is profoundly important and is in a way self-critical, I think, of the movement. You say this: half the problem is that progressives, their hands full with battling systemic economic and racial exclusions, tend to assume that big green groups have the climate issue covered. The other half of the problem is that many of the biggest big green groups have avoided with phobic precision any serious debate on the blindingly obvious roots of the climate crisis: globalization, deregulation, and contemporary capitalism's quest for perpetual growth. Talk a little bit about that sort of divide that there has been in the movement, because I was a climate change secretary in 2008, 2010. That there is this tendency to see climate change as, let's fix that problem, and then let's fix the economic problems.
Right.
And the beauty of the Green New Deal is it brings both together.
Right. And I think the problem with this idea that we could separate them, I mean, I think there are a lot of problems with it. I think it's just simply untrue, because at the heart of this crisis really is a crisis of overconsumption and a particular way of life that really isn't sustainable. But there's also just this cyclical problem that we encounter where when things are going relatively well economically, and you can kind of graph this, then that tends to be the moment where there'll be a lot of excitement and energy about doing something about the environment. And people sort of feel they're doing fairly well, so maybe they can pay a little bit more for things, and that's okay. But then as soon as there's an economic downturn, it just gets wiped off the map. And that's what happened in Europe with the 2008 financial crisis. It happened at a bit of a lag, yeah. Right? It wasn't really until 2009 where you just started to see it just completely, the bottom drop out. But I remember meeting with Alexis Tsipras before he was elected, when he was leader of the opposition. Yeah. And I made the case that to him, and I was working on This Changes Everything. I hadn't come out yet at the time. That it'd be a great time for a left party like his to bring together the climate crisis and the economic crisis, and talk about green jobs, and talk about how we can have a different kind of economy to get our way out of crisis, and we can have publicly owned renewable energy, community-owned renewable energy that will bring resources to communities to pay for services.
What did he say?
And he literally said to me, I think no is enough right now. And that's why my book, my last book was called No Is Not Enough. Because, he said to me, this is a moment of rejection. This is a moment where it's so important for Greeks to just reject this brutal austerity that is being enforced upon us, and this was a moment where people were filling the squares in Athens and so many other places in Southern Europe, and saying no, and that powerful rejection. And I think, to some extent, when you're in one of those moments, it's scary to actually pin down what you want, because you think that maybe it'll limit who's going to be with you. Because in those sort of effervescent moments where everyone's just saying no, we don't want this. That's a common binding agent, right? And you don't have to agree on much in order to all agree that you don't want that bad thing, right? Whether it's a dictator, or whether it's brutal austerity. But the problem is, when you open up that vacuum and you don't provide real solutions, then somebody fills the vacuum, right? I mean, Tsipras was elected, but I think the political disillusionment in Greece that has been left by the sort of failure to provide that vision, the Greek people are paying for that tremendously. They don't deserve that. And so it's our responsibility to not just reject, but also to propose what we want instead. And I don't know, I think there are lots of reasons why it took as long as it did to get to this point, this idea that somehow you can't ask people to care about the environment when they are in a place of economic hardship. I heard the same from Podemos's leadership, at the height of the economic crisis.
But to be fair, unless you place, as Macron has found out, the economic crisis, the environmental crisis, in a social and economic justice box, as well as take it out simply in an environmental box, then it's a fair worry.
Well, look, I mean, but I'm not arguing. I've never been arguing for neoliberal solutions to the climate crisis. And Macron has shown us very clearly what it looks like when you ask people who are already overstressed, overburdened, and watching your government attack trade union rights, impose economic austerity, hand out tax cuts to millionaires and corporations. Oh, and by the way, our climate plan is for you to pay more for gas. People will reject that, just as in Ecuador they rejected it. You can't pair economic austerity and attacks on the social safety net with asking regular people to pay more for carbon and call that a climate policy. Not only will the carbon pricing not get the job done, which is its own problem because the pricing is too low, but you will generate your own backlash. And Macron's just an extreme example of this. I mean, I live in the States right now, but I recently moved from Ontario, which is where I've lived most of my life.
You have two passports, correct?
I do, yeah. And we had a liberal government that introduced carbon pricing in Ontario that came to be associated with increased electricity costs. And we have our very own Donald Trump now, a guy named Doug Ford, famous because his brother was Rob Ford, famous for smoking crack and getting away with it. And he ran on a platform of rolling back the carbon pricing and giving people a buck a beer and rolling back sex education to 1992 levels.
So, not a good platform.
He's done it all, he's done it all but buck a beer.
So let me ask you then about this balance between So the way I sometimes talk about this is that I say to people, Martin Luther King didn't say, I have a nightmare. He said, I have a dream. And what is the balance, do you think? So I represent a relatively working class part of England, Doncaster North. Mm-hmm. High Brexit voting constituency. And I often think, and the reason I'm doing this Environmental Justice Commission in part is because I think, well, this has got to speak to my constituents.
Yeah.
What is the, if you were talking to a voter in my constituency, what is the balance between warning about the nightmare and the dangers for them and their kids and the dream, the jobs, the air quality, the... You know, all of the benefits, the public transport benefits, all of the social justice benefits. Do you need, you need both?
Yeah. I think you do. I think you need, you know, in the Sunrise Movement, they talk about promise and peril. And that's the moment that we're in. And I think the peril that we're in isn't only climate. I think people are frightened for the future on many different fronts. I mean, I think people don't even really see a future right now. So I think we just need, a holistic analysis that brings together the way we're treating our natural environment like trash and the way we treat people like trash. This sort of the extractive mindset, right, is not only about thinking we can exhaust nature without limit. It's also thinking we can exhaust people without limit. I mean, you look at what the gig economy, the way the gig economy treats workers and this sort of the endless, just the complete disregard and exploitation at the core of that. So I think we always need to connect the environmental and the social and labor in the peril and the promise. So, you know, I use a frame, and I used it when I spoke at the labor conference a couple of years ago, that we need to move from the dig and gig economy to a culture based on care and repair. And you know, one of the things I'm always banging on about in terms of the Green New Deal is that it's not just the classic green jobs that we need to talk about, the solar engineers and the people putting up wind turbines. That's all good, and we need that, and we can create millions of good jobs. But there's a lot of low-carbon work that's already being done that is overwhelmingly done by women, that is undervalued because it is women's work, and overwhelmingly women of color doing care work. And we need to fight to make those good jobs as well. So that's the care piece, and the repair piece, I think, has to do with repairing our relationship to the earth, repairing our stuff instead of just throwing it away and being in these cycles of constant obsolescence, and also repairing our relationships with the most abused communities, the people who have really borne the toxic burden. So, I don't know, I think that we just... I think we have the promise and the peril, but even more important is we have to constantly make the connections between what we're doing to the planet and what is being done
to people.
To people, yeah.
Then let me ask about a related issue, which is system change and individual change. I'm glad to say that there's a very good little booklet here, which I've taken, which is 9 things you can do about climate change. Now, I don't want to quote you out of context here, but partly to be provocative, I just quote you, what you say in the book, because I think it's important for the way we frame discussions about climate change. You say this: the hard truth is that the answer to the question, what can I as an individual do to stop climate change, is nothing. The very idea that we as atomized individuals could play a significant part in stabilizing the planet's climate system is objectively nuts. Now, I know you're not saying people should, like, just do what they like.
Right.
But I think if you think about the way certainly the critique of, like, Emma Thompson when she ended up at Extinction Rebellion, she flew there, the criticism of AOC, it very much sort of builds on the idea that it's all about what is the individual doing. Mm-hmm. Talk about this question of system change and individual change and what we as individuals should do.
Yeah. So I think, you know, as individuals, we should do what we can to lower our carbon footprints. It's a good thing to do. In many cases, it will make our bodies healthier. It will prove to ourselves that actually it's not the end of the world. And, you know, we hear a lot of scaremongering about how our quality of life will collapse if we take this crisis seriously. And it's good to know in your body that it isn't true. But I think it's actually really, really dangerous to make a fetish of, you know, being like the perfect low carbon activist, because it sends a message that you really can't join the movement until you've reached that level of purity. And the fact is that most people, and I'd imagine most people, you know, who you represent, are too busy, too overloaded, don't have access to a lot of what they need to make exactly. those low carbon choices, whether it's the kind of transit that exactly. they need, whether it is, you know, access even to healthy food. We have a lot of places that, you know, I mean, if you look at where fast food restaurants are located versus where health food stores are located and so on, right? So I think I worry that this fetish is a recipe for having a very privileged, overwhelmingly white movement, which has been true of the climate movement for a long time. And I think that is a failure on a lot of different fronts. It means that it's not representing the people who are most impacted by our extractive economy, because it is the poorest communities that get the dirtiest industries in their backyards, whose kids have asthma and, you know, bear the toxic burden in their bodies. But also because, just strategically, I actually think that a mostly privileged movement isn't going to fight hard enough. You know, the people who have the most to gain from the kind of transformative change that we're talking about are the people who are getting the worst deal in our current economy. And they would fight for this future, not because it's better than apocalypse and extinction, but because it's better than Tuesday, right? And so, you know, I think that there's been a real strategic mistake in thinking that, you know, it's possible to win, to build a movement capable of winning the kind of structural change that we're talking about without having a really working class movement.
Which the climate movement, for all its great virtues, is not at the moment.
Has not been. I mean, there is a wing of the climate movement that is the climate justice movement, and the climate movement is global and represents, you know, there are many different climate movements, but there is a part of the climate movement that, as Arundhati Roy says, it asks the question, how do I change without changing? You know, what is the least I can possibly do in the face of this crisis? Because this system is pretty much working well for me. I mean, can I get away with, you know, a marginal carbon tax, maybe an electric car? What is the least that I can do? Because I don't want to rock the boat, because the boat is basically working for me. And I mean, that makes sense for the winners in our current economic system. You know, and the fact is we have an increasingly unequal economic system, right? And so the people who are not the winners of that economic system are not afraid of change because they are being left behind. But they're expressing their desire for change, you know, in spasmodic and dangerous ways, like voting for Donald Trump or, you know, fill in the blanks.
Sorry. I also think sort of implicit in this, there's good news, which is that most people do want to go green, but are you going to make it possible for them to do so? I often cite mm-hmm. this statistic that I think 60% of cars in Norway that are sold are electric. I'm not saying electric cars are the answer to everything, but 3% are here. That's, now, we all right. love the Norwegians, but it's not simply because Norwegians are decent people.
No.
It's because the incentives are to go green in Norway.
Yes. Yeah.
And therefore, you're not just saying it's all up to the individual to do it.
Look, I mean, I often say I used to smoke a pack of cigarettes a day, and it wasn't that I didn't know that smoking was bad for me. I knew. And I stopped smoking when my government basically turned me into a complete pariah by banning smoking in restaurants and bars. And I found myself in a very cold climate, shivering outside alone, miserably, you know, sucking on a cancer stick. And I just thought it wasn't a good look, you know, and I eventually just gave it up. But, you know, I sometimes we need the help of government regulations. I'm willing to admit that I'm weak in that way, you know.
Talk to us about another big issue this week.
I just want to say one other thing about the personal thing. You know, you saw a little clip of me on Sky News this morning with Adam Bolton.
Did he ask you whether you came here by boat?
He didn't, but see, I asked him. I was, you know, I was dressed fairly smartly, and before the cameras rolled, I said, "Do I look nice? Because I want to make sure that I'm in the hypocrite camp and
uncooperative crusty."
Yeah. So and he was quite taken aback by that. Yeah. So he didn't ask me. But the point is, you're either a hypocrite, you know, or you're a crusty who shouldn't be listened to. There is no way to win this game.
Yeah.
You know. I mean, look at Greta. I mean, she sailed across the Atlantic. Has that quieted the trolls one bit? The whole reason why this is happening is because they would rather change the subject.
I think we should claim Krusty. I think we should claim Krusty as a virtue. I think he might have.
Let's claim Krusty. Yeah. Let's claim hypocrite.
Redefine and claim Krusty.
Change the subject.
Talk to us about growth and economic growth in this. And, you know, because clearly there's a massive aspect of this, which is the developing world and the fact that, you know, we've polluted the atmosphere. Developed countries have polluted the atmosphere, and now we are asking developing countries to not go down our route, but to change. And there's a huge debate in the movement about, you know, should you be agnostic about growth, anti-growth, but can you be anti-growth and still make this a working-class movement? Talk to us about how you think about that.
I think the way I think about it is I think what we cannot have is an economy that measures progress through the pursuit of indiscriminate growth. I think that is a recipe for what we have right now. But I am not a degrowth fanatic. I don't like the word. I don't think you build a movement for degrowth. And I also think there's going to be growth. So I think what we need is a designed, more deliberate economy where we identify the areas where we can have abundance, and we identify the areas where we need to have contraction in those areas that are exhausting the natural world and polluting it. We need to design to contract those areas. And we need to identify those areas where we can afford to have abundance that actually increase quality of life. I named a few. The arts, access to nature, the care professions. There's a lot of research.
All of which need to grow.
All of which can grow, and as we decarbonize them. Yeah. You know, I had an event at the university where I teach, Rutgers University, a couple of weeks ago, which we called Care Work is Climate Work, and we brought together leaders of teachers' unions and nursing unions and home care workers' alliances to talk about how to decarbonize their professions. They're already low carbon, but, you know, home care workers, you know, have to burn carbon in a lot of times getting from house to house because they don't have access to public transit. And there's definitely ways to make, you know, hospitals greener and so on. You know, we already have some fantastic examples for how to green the education sector. You know, so let's focus there and let's invest in those areas and let's make them better. Let's have smaller class sizes and pay teachers better and have more teachers and things like that. And, you know, our kids would be better educated, and that's, you know, that's a place we can grow. The tricky thing is we have to be honest that there is an actual risk of a Green New Deal carbon spike if we aren't serious about auditing our own carbon. Because if you're changing the building blocks of your society, this is a construction boom, right? It is a huge construction boom, and an economy that runs on fossil fuels, as you build out that renewable infrastructure, you're actually going to burn, ironically, a lot of carbon. And as you decide to pay people fair and good wages for their work, the Green New Deal in the U.S. talks about a jobs guarantee, you may well have people spending their salaries at Walmart and, you know, fueling the cycle of endless consumption. So there's going to have to be a way in which we keep ourselves honest about this. So I don't know. What do you think? How do you deal with the degrowth question?
Well, I think I'm in your camp, which is it depends. You know, Robert Kennedy said 50 years ago that growth was not the answer. And we've taken a long time to learn the lesson. It doesn't measure the things that really matter, environmental limits. There's no sense of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
It partly for me means you can't just have some green policies and then the rest of your economy.
Yeah.
And also, you've got to start getting into trade policy, and we can't just keep importing goods from other countries where you're using, you know, where you're sort of, you're kind of importing your high carbon.
Yeah, yeah.
Or rather, exporting your carbon.
I think as we design these Green New Deals or green industrial policies or whatever we're going to call them, I think we don't have to settle this question, the growth question, which is a very, very thorny question. But I do think we need to build in mechanisms to keep ourselves honest. So I think we need to be drawing on the world's leading emission reduction experts and be building in regular carbon audits to make sure that we aren't inadvertently, you know, burning too much carbon with the best of intentions, because we could well do that.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Okay, let's take questions now. I'll take them in groups of three. Yes, a question is sort of midway down on the left-hand side. And if you say your name as well.
Claire Sakia, I'm the Climate Change Director.
What's your first name, sorry?
Claire. At IIED. We're running up to COP26. We've got the next COP to go, but in the next just over a year, we've got a lot to do on climate action. And the politics globally just isn't looking good. The UK is leading the COP next year, but is very distracted. What can we possibly be doing?
Good question. And I think along the road, just the gentleman. Yep.
Joel from Carbon Tracker. You mentioned the obviously the fossil fuel industry, major problem. And you mentioned the 2008 financial crisis and the collapse of the financial system. So I guess my question for you is, what should we be guarding against, thinking back to, for example, 2010, when BP almost collapsed? There was sort of talks to rescue these oil companies. So how do we not repeat the mistakes of 2008 by bailing out the fossil fuel industry with no questions asked, not putting conditions on, shutting them down, executive pay, this sorts of things? So how can we be better prepared next time?
Okay, that's a good question. And then, yes, the lady here.
Hi, thanks. My name's Goodwin Gibbons. I'm a PhD student here at Imperial. I was wondering, thank you for a great talk, by the way. That was great.
What's your PhD on?
I do climate science.
Great.
And atmospheric physics. So I was wondering just if you could comment on what role you think negative emissions might play in helping to explain the gravity of emissions that make it into the atmosphere.
Just say the last bit again. What role negative emissions can play?
Yeah, maybe, for example, in helping to understand how hard it is to undo emissions that have been done, or anyway, what role you see for them in the future. Thank you.
What was your name, sorry?
Goodwin.
Goodwin, thanks.
Anybody have any easy questions?
Yeah, like negative emissions. Yeah, you can do the hard ones. I think there's quite a good range of things. I mean, just... I'm glad Claire asked this question about COP26 because, you know, with British understatement, Claire said we were distracted. I was at Copenhagen, so were
I
you?
I remember.
Yeah. You know, this requires every ounce of diplomatic muscle to make this a success, even when when the stars are well aligned and they're not that well aligned. So talk to us about that. What we can do, and the fossil fuel companies and negative emissions.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what can you do? So I think people are doing a lot, and I think that we are seeing a real shift in the political class feeling like they need to respond. Whether the policies are really there with teeth is another question, but I think that there has been that sense of emergency, that declaration of emergency from below, the sort of breaking of the cycle of people feeling terrified, alone, staring at their lonely screens, and then feeling like there's something wrong with them because everybody else is just talking about Brexit. I think we owe a lot to Extinction Rebellion and the student strikers for creating spaces for people to come together and be like, okay, it's not just me. I also see this as an emergency. But, you know, as I said earlier, I think no is not enough. I don't think it's enough to just declare an emergency, because emergencies are dangerous. States of emergencies are dangerous when you have untrustworthy elites. They can be used in all kinds of ways. You can declare a climate emergency and say, that's why we need to shut down the borders and just look after our own. We know what climate justice is. The Green New Deal comes out of decades of work from movements in the Global South and in frontline communities. And that's the importance of having our yes, having the vision that we are putting forward and working with political forces who are committed to turning it into law and making sure that they're committed. In terms of
vested interests, fossil fuel companies, the divestment campaign has been a great sort of success.
It has been, but there is, you know, and we need to go after the banks as well. We need to go after the banks and the hedge funds and the insurance companies that are underwriting this this industry. And I would encourage people to read Bill McKibben's really excellent essay in The New Yorker that really mapped the way in which these industries, the fossil fuel companies, are being underwritten by companies like BlackRock and JP Morgan and so on. We need to choose our targets in the way that we did in the fossil fuel divestment movement. And in terms of the companies themselves, we need to guard against what is sometimes called profitable bankruptcy, right? Which we saw with the coal companies, right? Where they declared bankruptcy, paid off their their executives handsomely, paid off in some cases their memberships at golf clubs, and screwed their workers and screwed communities. I think we are in the dying days of profits being made in this sector, and I believe the public has a right to those profits. This is an industry that has known since the 1970s that its business model was warming the planet.
Yep.
They spread doubt, they spread lies.
Covered it up.
And now we are stuck with the bill. And climate justice doesn't just mean that the people on the front lines of the crisis need to benefit from the solutions. It also means that the people who created the crisis with their eyes wide open need to pay for the costs of this. And so we need to figure out how to get the profits from the dying days of fossil fuels.
Just on negative emissions.
Yeah, negative.
Just help us out here. Sorry.
Well, I think you're talking about carbon drawdown, right? That what the IPCC has told us is that even if we do everything possible to decarbonize our economy, our economies globally, in this very tight time frame, we have already put too much carbon in the atmosphere beyond safe levels. So we actually need to draw some down.
Yeah.
So there's a few ways of doing that. So we're not talking about carbon capture technologies that are connected to new pollution. We're talking about the idea of air capture. So there are, you know, some technologies where you build kind of metal trees and actually suck that carbon out of the air and bury it underground. I think actual trees are pretty good at doing it. It doesn't require as much mining to get all that metal.
Some people have said, and I don't know what you think of, that countries should set targets for negative, to get into not just net zero, but negative emissions.
Right.
Which is one thing you could do.
You could. I mean, but I also think, you know, one of the things that's exciting about it and connecting it with land rehabilitation, reforestation, revegetation is that, you know, it should be connected with indigenous land rights. It should be connected with more sustainable farming. And it also is a way of addressing the fact that we also have an extinction crisis, right, and a biodiversity crisis. And just doing the right things when it comes to carbon does not necessarily redress this. And I think that George Monbiot has written really wonderfully about how, you know, solving the extinction crisis and solving the climate crisis can be done in tandem.
I would just add on Claire's question about COP26. I mean, there needs focus from the government, much more focus than I think there is. I think you need a much better near-term target for 2030, because 2050, you know, the IPCC have told us we've got 10 years. We're going to be trying to persuade other countries, including Europe, et cetera, to up their targets from Paris. We can't do that by saying, well, we're sticking to where we are for 2030, whether you agree with Labour's net zero or not. You've got to be more ambitious. And I think the movement is really important in this. I mean, when I was the climate change secretary at Copenhagen, we weren't even hosting the COP, but it was a massive movement here around Copenhagen. Yeah. Now, you don't want to create huge expectations and huge disappointment, but I think the movement pushed nationally, globally, is really, really matters. Let's take more questions. Yeah, we've got a question over here.
I'd just like to pick up on the point Naomi.
What's your name? Sorry.
Steve Sprung.
Hi, Steve.
I'd just like to pick up on the point you were talking about from the top and from below. Because in this country, in the late 70s, when Tony Benn was the Minister of Industry in this country, he encouraged workers to come in who were threatened with unemployment at the time and talk about what they could do to change about it, what they could do, what positive things they could come forward with instead of facing redundancies. And you've got to remember, that was the start of the mass redundancies in this country across the whole of the north of England, which led to the disenchantment, which led to the Brexit vote in the kind of areas you come from, Ed, yeah? And what Tony Benn did, he invited the workers in from Lucas Aerospace. And the workers in Lucas Aerospace were threatened with redundancy. 18,000 workers worked for Lucas Aerospace. And they came up in response to Tony, precisely from Tony Benn from the top, saying, come up with an alternative plan of what you could make instead of making jet aeroplanes for the military, right? They were threatened with redundancy really because of new technology, okay?
Lucas plan. Yeah.
And they came up with basically a Green New Deal plan.
Yeah, they did, yeah.
And their whole plan and what they did, they didn't just come up with, and it was accepted by the workers, all 18,000 workers, precisely because it offered them jobs.
Yeah.
But it was a Green New Deal. It was a Green New Deal.
Okay. Kind of activity. Thanks, Steve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exciting.
Sorry, in the middle.
Hi, my name is Alicia. I was just wondering what you think the role of big business would play alongside governments for a Green New Deal, and what you think about CEOs like Jeff Bezos who claim that they want to start sustainable initiatives, but then their whole business model is built on like fast and throwaway
cardboard boxes.
Okay, so this is the final, probably the final round. I'm going to take a few more, and then Naomi will get a choice as to who she, which ones she answers. Towards the back.
Oh, hi, George Taylor. I'm a postgrad at Centre of Environmental Policy. I think it was the Republican Party that first proposed a carbon tax in America, but somewhere along the lines, it became a very leftist issue. I'm wondering how we reconcile that and how we achieve bipartisan support.
Okay, there's an interesting question there, not just about the carbon tax, but bipartisan support. Yet there's a lady here.
You mentioned
What's your name, sorry?
Sorry, my name's Rebecca. I'm from the Institute and Faculty of Actuaries. You mentioned that Labour had done a particularly good job in thinking about green issues, but the Conservatives are in power at the moment, and their voter base is largely people in the baby boomer generation, mm-hmm. and often it's considered that this issue is quite a young person's issue and a future mm-hmm. generation's issue, in fact. How do we make this argument appeal to those generations who get out and vote more? And also, there's just more of them. So if they go out and they're voting for different parties that perhaps don't have this at the top of their agenda, how do we appeal to them?
So the older generation.
Yeah.
Why don't we kind of group those a little bit? Because there's two questions about sort of the role of business, mm-hmm. I think. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting generational question.
Yeah.
There's a question about consensus, because I didn't ask you this actually in the introduction, but, you know, how important is a consensus? Because the more radical you are, maybe the less you get the consensus. And then there's the Lucas plan. But just take them as you want, and then we can...
Yeah. So the question about companies like Amazon, who, you know, talk a good game about being green companies, but... sort of have a business model that is built on cardboard boxes and a pretty high carbon way of shopping generally, moving stuff around in boxes on trucks to people's houses. So it's really interesting what's been happening over the past, just the last few months, with workers at these companies. It's been a real shift. There's Amazon Workers for Climate Justice group that I think 1,600 of them signed a petition. They brought it to shareholders, calling for Amazon to massively up its game when it comes to decarbonization. So I guess I don't put a lot of stock in what CEOs declare they're going to do. I've been around for a while. I've heard a lot of pledges. Remember when Richard Branson promised he was going to solve climate change at the Clinton Global Initiative? And put all of his profits from all of his transportation companies into coming up with the solution to climate change. Have we heard anything about that lately? Anyway, I'm cynical about that, but I'm not cynical about workers' power. And for the first time, there was a job action at Amazon. I think more than 1,000 Amazon workers participated in the climate strike. A few weeks ago, there was a good showing from Microsoft, good showing from Google. Google workers, there's really interesting things going on in the tech sector with worker organizing right now. We've seen big walkouts, 20,000 workers at Google walking off the job. And it's connected to this, to demanding higher ethics from these companies, whether it's sexual harassment, whether it's not doing contracts with the military, not doing contracts with border agents and being part of the machinery of deportation. Once again, it's like an inside-outside pincer where you have university students saying we don't want these companies recruiting on our campuses if they're part of deportation and surveillance, but you also have workers. You know, the hashtag is tech won't build it, if you want to look into it. And there's just great stuff going on now, frankly, and they are pushing some more meaningful changes from these companies. So I'm not ready to say that Amazon is green, but after this, ahead of the climate strike, when it was clear that there was going to be this big walkout at Amazon, Bezos announced that he was buying 100,000 electric vehicle delivery for delivery, and that, you know, that's a pretty substantial change. He also upped his targets and so on. It's not where they should be, and people walked out anyway because they weren't buying it, but. It's something new to see that this level of tech worker organizing, and I'm excited about it. So
the Lucas plan, you in favor of what Steve was talking about?
That's brilliant.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a really, really important labor history for us to know. And it's also important for us to remember, you know, the next time there is, a factory being shut down, or dock workers losing their jobs, that there needs to be these types of collaborations.
And the just transition is absolutely central to this, if it's going to be genuinely a movement for everybody.
Exactly. And these workers should have before their machines are sold off and before all their assets go to auction, they should have a chance to develop a plan to turn their workplaces into green cooperatives. And if they've got a good plan, then it should be funded. And they need solidarity from academics who can help them come up with the plans. Where I've seen this happen, there's been wonderful collaborations with academia and workers. And the green movement needs to show up for these workers.
Yeah.
So, the bipartisanship question, like, I could go on for a long time, but I'm just going to try to be brief. So we can maybe one day, once again, get bipartisan support for a marginal carbon tax. But the problem is that this party has gone so far off the deep end and wasted so many years that the kind of policy that you could get bipartisan support for would be so very weak and inadequate considering how much we need to do in so short a time that I think it's a waste of energy. I think what we need to do is build super majorities and try to get real climate plans passed, Green New Deal, which will not get bipartisan support. And then we need to roll it out in communities and do what FDR did. And FDR was very, very smart when he rolled out the New Deal. He made sure, he looked at a map, he looked at the communities that voted Republican in 1933, and he put Green New Deal projects in those communities where they didn't support the Green New Deal. And they had jobs and they had services. And lo and behold, in 1936, many of them voted for him. And that's how you got bipartisan support, by actually creating jobs and showing people what it looks like on the ground.
And the Institute of Actuaries question about how do you motivate the older generation as well as the younger generation?
I'm glad you asked. This is a passion of mine because I actually think it's quite dangerous the way in which the climate crisis is being framed as a young people's issue. It is true that young people, that the younger you are, the longer you will live in a climate disrupted future, and the more climate disruption you will see if we do not change course. But if you actually look at the timelines for when this is really going to be hitting us, and we're already experiencing some major disruption, it is absolutely going to be in your lifetime and mine, and in the lifetime of those of middle-aged people. And what I say to them is, at least the young people will be able to run. I have tried this as a new motivating tactic. And I'm actually pretty serious, because if you look at who is most vulnerable to climate disruption, climate change exacerbates pre-existing vulnerabilities, right? So the people who are most vulnerable in disasters are the elderly, are the disabled, are people who are ill, who have mobility issues, and who need there to be some kind of infrastructure of care to help them. And this is no joke. And the idea that we just offload this onto young people is, it is, in my opinion, a moral atrocity, but it is also just for base self-interest, a very silly thing for middle-aged people to do.
Great. So I'm going to ask you a final question. This talk that we've, the conversation we've had today, is going to go out on my podcast. This is a shameless plug for my podcast called Reasons to Be Cheerful. Downloadable on all good platforms.
At least, at least the young people will be able to run. Is that a reason to be cheerful?
Yeah. I want to give you the final word. Tell us a reason to be cheerful, but also, you know, what, you know, send this audience out to go and not just buy your book. They should all buy your book straight after this, but to go and do things. What message do you want to leave them with?
I like the slogan of the UK climate strikers. They wrote a piece during the ahead of the March 15th climate strikes. They said, Greta was the spark, but we are the wildfire. And I said before that if we want to win this epic battle, and it is a battle because we really are up against forces that are protecting a huge amount of capital, then we really have to be on fire for it. It's going to take an extraordinary amount of energy and focus and determination. Young people right now are, as Greta said at the UN, giving up their childhoods to try to wake up the world. And so I think we all have to ask ourselves what we are willing to give up, what we're willing to really have that kind of focus for. And so I guess my reason to be cheerful is that there's a huge generational shift going on right now. And I think that our generation, we grew up in the grips of neoliberalism's war on the imagination, right? Whether or not we were Thatcherite, we still absorbed this idea that there is no alternative, that we had reached the end of the history, that there was nothing but this, there was no escape from this bleak reality. Anything we tried to do would be worse. And we really got the hard sell, but I think that people who have come of age in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis, when the neoliberal project has been in ideological retreat, if not in retreat with policies. The policies are still there, but the hard sell isn't there. So we now have a lot of young people who never got the memo that history was over, who never were told that they weren't supposed to dream or that there is no alternative, and are daring to have those dreams and to have that vision of a future that doesn't look like every cli-fi movie we've ever seen. So I think that's for me, that's a huge reason to be cheerful. I've never seen anything like it in my lifetime, and I believe in it. You know, we've got a chance.
Very good. So let me do some thank yous. I want to thank Imperial, the Grantham Institute, the IPPR. Look out for the Commission on Environmental Justice. We're going to be talking about how we build this route map to the future that Naomi is talking about. Be the fire. That is first by the book. Then
be laid it on fire.
Then be the fire. Please put your hands together for Naomi Klein. Thank you.
Great job.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Oh, we're in the outro.
Shall I give special thanks to IPPR?
A special thanks to the IPPR Environmental Justice Commission, which I continue to co-chair with Caroline Lucas and Laura Sands, and they made possible that conversation. Thanks to Naomi, obviously.
Before we go, we should say we are going back out on the road. It's been a long time because there was the election and then there was all the stuff going on with Brexit, and we weren't able to book any live shows throughout the whole of the autumn. But come the springtime,
the green shoots of podcast recovery.
Yeah.
It's Thursday the 12th of March. We're at King's Place in the evening. You can buy tickets now. And we're going to be talking about the environment and climate change, which is part of their Nature Unwrapped series running throughout 2020.
Really looking forward to it. This is a great venue. It's in London. If you know London, it's in the new King's Cross area where The Guardian have their headquarters. We did a live show there probably like 18 months ago, and it was one of the best ones. And we're really excited.
We're going to have a blast.
We are. That's exactly what we're going to have. We're going to have a blast. And Emma Caution produces our podcast with backup and research from Joel Pierce and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed made the music. James Deacon made the idents. And the artwork wasn't designed by Emily Power. Or who else wasn't it designed by?
It wasn't designed by Lucy Hall, who gets a shout out from her friend Daisy Crawley.
So neither designed by Emily Power nor Lucy Hall, but it was in fact designed by Henry Cole.
He's been in Mexico.
He's been holding the fort.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.